We've got a special guest. This is part two of our series with Dr. Tom Cowan. His new book that we've been discussing, Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness. Dr. Cowan, welcome. Thank you for coming back for more. Real quick, just for the listeners who may not have caught last week's show, which I encourage everybody to go listen to in our archives, but I was just going to kind of do a real brief snapshot, and then we'll dive into the rest of the book. But last week, we really kind of explained in depth about the immune system, kind of the two parts of the immune system, the first responders, I called them, I think. And those are the cells, the cell-mediated immunity, the ones that initially see these viruses and bacteria and mount the immune response, which is what produces all the fever and snot and aches and diarrhea and, you know, the sick. But then there's the memory cells. The after the first responders, you've got to have the antibody-producing cells. I call them the memory cells, need to kick in so that you'll make antibodies to these germs, and they will, your body will be able to quickly recognize and eradicate them in the future after that first exposure. So it's a very intricate, delicate, and beautifully designed system, first responders and memory cells. And I think the point of that, really the book, but definitely our first part one of our interview, was to explain that the purpose of the current vaccine schedule in our country is to bypass the first responders and to just stimulate the memory cells, the antibody-producing cells. And we've done that very successfully. We've bypassed the first responders. We've created all these antibody-producing cells. So we've got a population, I believe we said 140 or 150 million people with autoimmune diseases walking around with antibodies. We discussed how the adjuvants, which are the extra things put into the vaccine, aluminum, mercury, glyphosate, other chemicals, these adjuvants' whole job, their sole purpose is to stimulate this antibody response. So basically, we've gotten what we paid for. In fact, there's now a syndrome called the Schoenfeld syndrome, I believe Dr. Cowan told us. It's an autoimmune disease induced by these adjuvants that are in the vaccines. So I encourage everybody to go back and listen to that and understand how the immune system is supposed to work and how it has become deranged in part by all these adjuvants in the vaccine that is bypassing the first responders. So it was a great interview. We got to talk about shingles, chickenpox, measles. What we did not get into, though, and the book really, I think, did a fantastic job of going through the history of the polio epidemic. And the polio epidemic, which I did not have to live through, had such an impact on so many lives, an emotional impact and physical impact. In fact, one of my wife's aunts, I remember the family telling the story how her parents had to take her to the Shriners Hospital in Dallas. And, I mean, that's a 4 or 5 hour drive, and would have to leave her there for days and weeks at a time and for the better part of a year because of the polio symptoms that she had. And she still suffers from permanent damage, has a limp. So it's a very personal to lots of people, very emotional topic. But The book really did a fantastic job of diving into some of the facts and some of the unanswered questions about that. So I wanted to touch on that, and then really the rest of the show we're going to get into the intracellular water, and that's the most fascinating part of the discussion. But Dr. Cowan, I think we do need to, if you don't mind, maybe give the listeners some of the history of this polio epidemic and kind of the number one, where did this virus come from, or is it a virus? And just some of that history that you went into with the book, specifically the sugar plantations. I thought that was fascinating, how they had to use a certain pesticide on the sugar, and the sugar was one of those things. Candy seemed to be one of the correlations. People that were getting these polio symptoms were exposed to sugar or candy somehow. So can you go into some of that history for the listeners?
Yeah, and there's also a book which I just read last week, so I hadn't read it before I wrote my book, called The Moth in the Iron Lung, which actually goes through pretty much, the whole book is about the history of polio. Mm. So polio is the name that is not actually referred to a virus. It means basically it means it used to be called infantile or childhood paralysis. So any child who has an acute syndrome and is paralyzed, that was called polio. So what we know about this situation is there were very few, if any, recorded cases of this polio infantile paralysis, childhood paralysis, before around 1870. When we look at indigenous tribes and actually look for presence of immunity against the virus, pretty much most of the tribes that have been studied have 100% immunity to the virus and no reported incidents or cases of any kind of paralysis or any particular sickness from it. So presumably that was the case before 1870 in the Western world. Essentially, there was this harmless enterovirus. An enterovirus means the virus enters the body through the intestinal tract, and nobody was particularly getting sick by it. And then there was a couple of sporadic outbreaks, you know, first in Europe, and then the first big one in the United States was in Vermont. So the first question one needs to ask is, so if this was a viral disease, what happened in 1870 to now all of a sudden people were getting paralyzed by this virus that up until then, as far as we know, for the history of humanity had been harmless? So one of the things that was found was that was the introduction, because of the basically the spread of gypsy moth that started in Massachusetts in around 1870. So gypsy moths were essentially decimating the oak trees all over the northeast of the United States, and this was a ecological catastrophe. And so there was a big cry to do something about it, and what was done about it was basically the spraying of arsenic onto the trees. The cattle were dipped in arsenic, and particularly on the apple trees, there was the first time spraying of arsenic, which had at least some effect on the gypsy moth. Eventually, because the arsenic didn't really stick to the leaves well, and so it didn't work as well, they changed it around that time to something called lead arsenic. And so, essentially, for the first time, lead arsenic was being sprayed on food items and sprayed essentially all over the area, and in first place they did it was in Vermont. The interesting thing about arsenic, and in particular lead arsenic, which sticks for weeks and even months onto the leaves and onto the fruit, is lead arsenic is a specific neurotoxin, meaning neurological, you know, nervous system poison for what's called the anterior horn cells of the nervous system, which is the part of the spinal cord that can, where the motor neurons or the nerves that control movement go, which is exactly the place that polio affects, and it's exactly the place that we were told the polio virus affected. So maybe coincidentally, although I don't think so, the first epidemics of or the first outbreaks of paralytic polio came coincident with the spreading of lead arsenic onto the food crops and onto the apple orchards in Vermont. And then things kind of calmed down, and then they started getting around 1900 more and more of these outbreaks as more and more lead arsenic was spread all over the eastern part of the United States. And then eventually this arsenic was used on the sugar plantations in Hawaii at first, because they couldn't basically profitably grow sugar without using some sort of pesticide. Turns out that the lead arsenic concentrates in the sugar, and the sugar was being shipped to the cities on the eastern seaboard, and you would get these outbreaks that were associated with certain candy stores that were making sugar, you know, making candy from sugar imported from the Hawaiian Islands instead of the sugar imported from Cuba, where they hadn't yet started using this lead arsenic. And again, lead arsenic is a specific neurotoxin of the very part of the nervous system that's affected by polio and supposedly the polio virus. Interestingly, around 1907 or so, there was an experiment done that even to this day is referenced as the proof that polio is caused by a virus. And what they did, because they couldn't find an animal model where they could basically feed an animal a polio virus and have them get polio. It seemed like no animals would get polio. So they were unable to sort of get an experimental model because the animals simply wouldn't get polio by drinking polio virus. So they finally did an experiment and found that rhesus monkeys, or specifically New World rhesus monkeys, were susceptible to getting paralytic polio. So they took two children who had died of paralysis, that is to say, died of polio, and they took the cerebrospinal fluid out of these two children who had died, and they gave it orally to these rhesus monkeys, and then nothing happened. And they injected it subcutaneously into the monkeys, and then nothing happened. And then finally, they injected it right into the brain, into the ventricles of these two rhesus monkeys. And one of the monkeys got paralyzed, and the other monkey died. And mind you, this is unpurified cerebrospinal fluid from a child who died of paralysis. So we have no idea what was in that cerebrospinal fluid. Zero. It wasn't filtered. There was no virus isolated. They didn't know how to isolate viruses in any case at that time. And, you know, there's no way to know what really happened. And yet, even to this day, that is still considered the proof that polio is caused by this transmissible virus. Even though there's no explanation as how an enterovirus that enters into the body through the GI tract somehow would cause disease when it didn't cause disease entering through the GI tract, and you only would cause disease if you injected it into the brain of the monkeys, which is by no means what normally happens. So right. To me, that leaves a lot of questions. As time went on, then, you know, people started questioning whether lead arsenic was actually good for people because there was all kind of collateral damage, as is always the case with these toxic pesticides. Eventually, then, DDT came into use, which had been invented into the 1870s, which was sort of the new miracle drug for getting rid of mosquitoes and flies and any other insect. They were using DDT. They would dust children's clothes with it. It was in teething powders. It was on all the food. They sprinkled it in lunch boxes so you wouldn't get flies in your lunch boxes. And interestingly, DDT is yet another neurotoxin specific for the anterior horn cells of the nervous system. Again, exactly the place that's supposedly affected by the polio virus. So this then led to the outbreaks that most of us have heard of in the 40s and early 50s. DDT was being massively used. It was sprayed on all the ball fields. It was basically sprayed everywhere. And many of the physicians at that time were saying that this paralysis that we're seeing in epidemic proportions now all over the United States was not because of a transmissible virus, but was because of a direct poisoning of children with DDT. One of the most interesting and final parts of this picture, and again, you can go on for hours just going through the details of this, was the biggest outbreak, or at least one of the biggest outbreaks of paralytic polio was in Detroit in 1958, 869 people were diagnosed with polio. And at that time, they did an exhaustive study because they knew how to isolate and find viruses by that time. So they did their stool and their blood, and they looked for polio in the anterior horn cells of the people and children who had died. And they came out with the number that exact out of this 869 cases of polio, 292 had any evidence that they had ever been exposed to a virus. Which, of course, means that about two-thirds of them had never been exposed to a virus, or at least not polio, and they had no idea why they had polio. And that should have been, in a sane world, the death knell for this paralytic disease was only caused by a polio virus, because it's simply, there's just no evidence for that. I would also point out that the people who think that the injectable Salk vaccine was responsible for eradicating polio, this was hugely controversial at the time. Essentially, nobody believed it in the medical community. And just for some numbers, in 1952, there was 3,345 cases of death from polio. And in 1955, there was only 221. This coincided with the officials saying we should curb the use of DDT in, you know, dusting it on children and putting it in their lunchbox and dusting their food with it. So basically, they stopped that, and that was before the polio vaccine came into use. So once again, we find that the decreasing incidence of one of these diseases like measles or mumps or diphtheria, actually, when you actually look at the numbers, had nothing to do with the introduction of the vaccine.
Yeah, I think that brings a lot of comfort to, I know a lot of my patients, a lot of my mothers that bring their kids in, when I start to explain that sanitation accounted for, I've read, anywhere up to like 97% of reduction of these infectious agents. And people forget at the turn of the century, the urban crowding, the poor sanitation, lack of clean water, lack of good nutrition when everybody was moving to these cities and the food was out in the country. So there are many factors involved in what I call the terrain that, of course, now we understand and have total control over, or much more control over, our choices of our terrain and what impacts our terrain. So just getting that terrain right helps your body's own immune system do what it's supposed to do.
Right. And it should go without saying, but, you know, if you're going to expose people to two of the deadliest neurotoxins, both of which were well known at that time, to specifically affect the area of the nervous system that results in paralysis, that those being lead arsenic and DDT, you know, some humans are going to be susceptible to damage from that insult.
Yeah.
And the history, the epidemiology is clear that when we were started to be exposed to those influences, we got the disease.
Right.
When we stopped, the disease went away. It had nothing to do with the virus and the vaccine and all the other things that were we were told that made a good story of, you know, humans overcoming nature, so to speak.
Right.
But it doesn't hold up under scrutiny.
Yeah. Well, I think kind of my take home when I read the book was, wow, this virus, the virus that they did eventually associate with polio has been in our gut for a long time, a normal enterovirus, part of our normal flora for 1,000 years, never caused a problem. And I think in your book you talked about the one of these toxins on the sugar cane also induced hyperpermeability of the gut wall or affected the brush border in the gut wall, damaged the gut wall that would allow entry of some of these bugs. Yeah. And again, that's a terrain issue. When you consume a toxin, I mean, the toxin for sure itself damages the nerves, but it also disrupts the gut, and you've got to have a healthy gut to have a healthy immune system.
Right. So, arsenic itself, one of the reasons why it may have been, you know, the body spends a lot of effort trying to protect the nervous system. So you have to do some direct insult to first, you know, disturb the gut barrier, which arsenic does, and then it also increases the permeability through the sort of blood-brain or nerve-blood border.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that now, you know, we're actually injecting children with polio virus that's certainly attenuated, so it's not as virulent as it used to be, or as alive as it used to be. But we also put in things into the vaccine certain surfactants and other agents which facilitate the absorption of these antigens that we're injecting, but they also facilitate the permeability of the blood-brain barrier.
Yeah.
So if that isn't a dangerous situation, I don't know what is.
Yeah. Well, can you speak to internationally, have there been polio outbreaks? Are there still, or is there a correlation with DDT? I know they've used DDT overseas to try to, I'm sure, control mosquitoes from malaria and stuff like that. Can you speak to that, the international component?
Well, the other thing that's worth mentioning is one of the other tricks they use to tout the success of certain interventions like vaccines. So before the Salk vaccine, the definition of acute paralytic polio was 2 consecutive days of decreased muscle strength. As soon as the vaccine came into being, you had to have decreased muscle strength, i.e. some sort of paralysis, 60 days after the initial onset of paralysis.
Mm.
So the whole diagnostic criteria was changed,
right,
which then dramatically reduced the incidence of the disease.
Yeah.
It's very clever, of course, but it has no relation to what people want to know, which is, did this actually work? And so now, I don't have the exact number on the tip of my tongue, but I think last year in India, there's now a disease called acute flaccid paralysis, which is exactly the early descriptions of polio, which was basically paralysis without any sensory symptoms. Only now it's not called polio, but it used to be called polio. Now it's called acute flaccid paralysis. And there was approximately 50,000 cases of acute flaccid paralysis, some ending up in death and some ending up in permanent disability, in 1 year in India. India is a huge user still of DDT, and they didn't have polio or acute flaccid paralysis until the introduction of DDT, which is basically the same story. It's either lead arsenic or DDT, every place that ends up getting polio. The other places are immune to the virus and have no disease that we know of that would be correlated with that. So India is out there touting that their vaccine program got rid of paralytic polio, but meanwhile they have 50,000 or so cases of exactly what we would have called polio in the 1950s,
yep,
and they seem to think that has nothing to do with it.
Yeah,
I mean, the situation, it's really boggles the mind when you actually getting to know the details, like what are these people thinking of, like,
yeah,
what difference, I mean, how come just calling it acute flaccid paralysis makes it somehow different than calling it polio?
Right.
You know, and even in the United States now, the CDC has put out a warning just in the last few weeks that these cases of acute flaccid paralysis, of which they have no idea what the etiological agent is, are coming to be more seen in the United States, and everybody should report it. And I'm sure it's, you know, there's probably some new pesticide or herbicide out there that we don't know about that's being used, that's probably the third, essentially the third generation anterior horn toxin. And it seems like they just never learned.
Yeah. Or some things are more important.
Or some things are more important.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to ask you about that, so I'm glad you touched on it. The headlines that are coming out about the polio-like symptoms that
acute
are coming.
Flaccid paralysis.
Yeah.
It's exactly. Anybody who's interested in this, first of all, should read this book. But they should look at the definition from 1930 or 1940 of what polio is, mm-hmm. and how it got changed.
Yeah.
So now you have to find the virus. But it's the same. Then they didn't find the virus in 1930 or 1940.
Yeah.
In all of these epidemics, the amount of times they found the virus, basically zero. They didn't look. They didn't know how to look.
Yeah.
Anybody who was paralyzed or had weakness of their muscles for even 2 days had polio. We still have that. And now we just don't call it polio. So now we've cured polio.
Right. Oh, it'll make you want to pull your hair out sometimes.
Right.
The way not only data can be manipulated, but just outright, you know, let's change the definition or the requirements for the diagnosis to 60 days. Well, that's fascinating. I'm going to have to read The Moth and the Iron Lung, you said, was the name of the book
you just mentioned? The Moth and the Iron Lung. Very easy to read, and it's a good story about what happened. And anybody who reads that who thinks that polio is simply a viral disease. I don't know. You can't possibly come away with that thinking that that's true.
Yeah. Well, we're all about informed consent at our clinic, and I think every clinic should be all about informed consent. So that's the way you get folks informed, is you dig down deeper into the truth and you talk about it. So I'm going to start to definitely recommend that book. But I want to mention the name of your book again for those that just joined us. Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness is Dr. Thomas Cowan's new book. His first book, or I guess, was Human Heart, Cosmic Heart your first book?
There was two earlier ones from New Trends that were Fourfold Path to Healing and the Nourishing Traditions book of Baby and Child Care.
Oh, that's right. I've seen that one.
I
recommend those also, but for sure this latest book, Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness, is highly recommended. We're up against a break. When we come back, we're going to get into the other fascinating part of the book that might seem like it's not connected, but it is. And it's about structured water. It's about energy production in the cell. It's about the mitochondria, the cell membrane, and how does a cell really work and really keep normal function and create energy. So we're going to get into some cell physiology and some new theories when we get back from the break. So stick with us with Dr. Tom Cowan. We'll be right back. Okay, we are back. We've got Dr. Thomas Cowan here on the line for part two of our interview. I encourage everyone to go back and listen to part one from last week. That is found on our website in the archives of the radio shows. It's also on iTunes under You're the Cure. I encourage y'all to subscribe to that. I just had a patient this morning tell me that she knows what to do. She just needs motivated to do it. And listening to the radio shows every week helps to keep her motivated. So I encourage all you patients and even non-patients to go listen to that and get motivated to know the why behind why we're trying to tell everybody to go live and eat the way your ancestors did when there wasn't all this chronic disease. So anyways, little plug for the show there, but back with Dr. Cowan, I want to dive into in the rest of the time we have, the next 30 minutes or so, the fascinating theory. It reminded me really of your book, Human Heart, Cosmic Heart. You explained to everybody that the heart's not really a pump. It's more of a hydraulic effect, and it kind of pulls the water, kind of like sucking through a straw. The blood is pulled up and through the blood vessels by this hydraulic force that the heart muscle creates, and then we've got to get away from this thinking of that it's a forceful pump that squeezes the blood through the system. a similar new revelation and theory about energy production in the cell. So really, Dr. Cannon, I just want to jump right into, I'll let you explain kind of the traditionally what we're taught, even down in high school science class, definitely college and graduate school level. Pretty much the whole world believes in this sodium-potassium pump, but give your explanation of the old way of thinking and why you don't think that way anymore, and then we'll get into more of this, the new theory of energy production.
So one of the mysteries of cell biology, and particularly with, I guess, mammals, particularly, but maybe with other creatures as well. But I don't know much about insects, so let me just stick to mammals and humans. How do we live in a salty environment? You know, the blood and the extracellular fluid has a lot of sodium in it. Yet when we look at the inside of our cells, it's a sodium-poor, potassium-rich environment. So that question was one of the central mysteries of cell biology since, I would say, the mid or early 1700s, because they knew that the cells are bathed in this highly salty mixture, but yet if the salt, meaning the sodium, gets into the cell, that signals death of the cell. So there was, you know, one of the biggest efforts in the history of biology, and particularly cell biology, to sort this out, and the project was on many continents over many decades, even centuries. And I don't know exactly when or who came up with this, but figured it out. But they eventually came out with the model that a human cell or any mammalian cell is essentially a bag of water with a cell membrane surrounding the water. The cell has two parts, essentially. It has a nucleus and it has a cytoplasm. The cytoplasm is the watery part. And the cytoplasm is a low-sodium, high-potassium environment. And the outside of the cell is a high-sodium, low-potassium environment. And the way it gets there is because there's this sodium-potassium pump embedded in the cell membrane, which hooks on to the sodium on the inside of the cell and potassium on the outside, and then it does a kind of merry-go-round, so it swings to the other position, and it deposits the potassium on the inside, and the sodium goes outside of the cell. And the repercussions of this sodium-potassium pump are that creates a separation of charges inside and outside the cell, so that the cell essentially has a halo of negative charges around it, which allows the cell to function like a battery, and in other words, to do work. And it also, because each cell has this negatively charged halo around it, it allows the cells to maintain a proper spatial orientation, one cell from the next, because they all have this negative charge, and negative charges repel, and that keeps them from clumping together, and they can keep their distance. And a liver can be composed of these millions or trillions of these cells, all with the correct spatial orientation. So this sodium-potassium pump was hailed as one of the greatest discoveries in the history of science and biology. Many Nobel Prizes were given for the elucidation of it and the different proteins that make it up and how you can affect it with different drugs, and digoxin affects it and many other drugs, and many of our commonly used drugs in, you know, medicine today have some effect on this all-important sodium-potassium pump. So that's sort of the normal theory. Now, the first time I started to question this was back when I was in medical school and resident and then as ER doctor, because The first premise of this theory is that the cytoplasm is made out of approximately 70% water with a bunch of other stuff dissolved in it, like mitochondria and ribosomes and proteins and all the rest of it. And also, as you alluded to, since somewhere around third or sixth grade, I don't remember exactly, but we were told that all matter can exist in one of three phases: solid, liquid, or gas. So here I am as an ER doctor, knowing that 70% of these patients' cells are made of water, and yet some of them had, you know, stab wounds and gunshot wounds and, you know, scissors wounds and all kinds of stuff that basically plunged into their leg or arm or whatever. And yet I never once saw a gusher of water come squirting out of somebody's leg. Nor did I see a puddle of water laying next to the gurney of somebody who had been shot. And so at some point I asked myself, because there's this phenomena, you know, that we're like told things that we're supposed to believe, but our direct experience doesn't line up with that information. I think some people have called that cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, so, I was just explaining that very term to a medical or a undergrad student shadowing at our clinic. I said, you're going to see some things here that don't line up, and it's going to give you a lot of cognitive dissonance, which may lead to a headache.
Yes. And so for whatever reason, for me, I liked those things. I was never put off by them because I always was suspicious of sort of, you know, conventional wisdom or something like that. And so I looked into that, and it wasn't much to look into now. But eventually what I learned, and this is not till years later, was that water and only water can exist in not just three phases, but there's a fourth phase called the gel phase, or structured water, or exclusion zone water. There's a lot of different names for it. And I would say to people, it's the same as Jell-O. So Jell-O is essentially 90-some percent water plus proteins, and you take the Jell-O, gelatin, and put it in water, and then nothing happens. And so you heat the solution, and that unfolds the proteins, and then they serve as the nidus point for the water to gel, and it assumes this previously unrecognized and, you know, denied phase called the fourth phase of water. And it's only water that does that. If you think about the cells, the reason there's no water in the cells, or there's no liquid water, is because 100% of the water in the cells is in this gel phase, which is why it doesn't leak out when you get a stab wound. And in a sense, the same way that you make Jell-O is how this structured or gel phase water is made in the cells. You have essentially proteins that are formed like the lattice inside the cell, and they are energized, and I'll talk about that in a second maybe, and so that they unfold and they interact with the water to create this gel. And that's the actual status of the cytoplasm in any mammalian cell. Now, the repercussion of this, and for anybody who's interested in a very long and somewhat tedious but brilliant explanation of this, there's a biologist named Gilbert Ling who studied this for decades and wrote extensively on it. And he was able to prove that, number one, if you actually do the energy dynamics of the sodium-potassium pump, what you find is that in order for the sodium-potassium pump to pump all the sodium out and the potassium in, it would need 40 times the energy available to a human cell to do everything. The analogy I make, it's like if you have a mortgage of $40,000 a month and your salary is $2,000 a month, you're eventually not going to have enough money to pay your mortgage, let alone buy food and clothing and whatever else you need. So that's the state of the cell. And so he was able to prove that basically this sodium-potassium pump, it's not a myth. There is a pump. It's like a backup generator to use only in emergencies. So the question then is, how does this separation, this, I would say, all-important separation of sodium-potassium and therefore the energizing of the cell and therefore the charge around the cell, how does that come about? And it's actually very simple. The gel formation of the water has the mesh is perfectly organized so that it accepts and collects the potassium and does not accept or is not able to incorporate the sodium. So the sodium is just by the nature of the size of the gel mesh is pushed out of the cell, and the potassium, just by the same nature of the size of the mesh, is collected in the cell. That's how the cell charge comes about. That's how the sodium potassium, there is no pump. You don't need a pump. You don't need to waste all your energy pushing this out and pulling that in. It just happens through this fourth phase nature of water all by itself. And that runs everything. And you can't emphasize how important the integrity of this crystalline gel is to cell biology. Now, the energetic part of this is just like when you make Jell-O, you put proteins in water and you have to add some energy in the form of heat. The analogy to the heat in the living system is this chemical molecule called ATP, which we're told is the energy molecule of any living system. But again, Ling was able to prove there is no more energy in an ATP molecule than any other molecule. But what it does is the ATP attaches to these proteins inside the cytoplasm, and that changes their configuration to allow them to interact with water to create this gel. So some people say that I'm saying that ATP isn't necessary, and that's not true. It is necessary, because without the ATP, you can't organize the water. But it's not that it's creating energy. That's nonsense. You can prove that with just basic thermodynamics. It just unfolds the proteins and allows them to interact with the water.
Wow. Okay. That's awesome. I mean, let me kind of summarize that a little bit if I can. I mean, the main point I think listeners need to know is our cells need to be charged. They need to be batteries, meaning they need to build this effect where there's a difference in charge between the inside and the outside of the cell. Not only to repel, the halo effect repels other cells nearby to keep the right space in between our cells so they can function the right way, but also the energy for the cell to actually do its work. Every cell in the body has work to do. Your hamstring cell, your brain cells, your heart muscle cell, your immune system cells, and so the energy has to come from somewhere. So that it's critical to have this charge in the cell. And the water, this intracellular fourth phase structured water, all by itself creates that charge. And what Ling, I don't know if you mentioned this in the book, you mentioned it, how Ling, a couple different things. You could poke a lot of holes in the cell membrane with a micropipette, basically, damage the cell membrane, and the sodium and the potassium difference, all the sodium outside the cell, all the potassium inside the cell, would stay the same, even with all these holes in the cell membrane. And then I think you said Ling went on to disable these pumps, the sodium-potassium pumps, and it still maintained the charge. Again, I mean, obviously that just proves the whole point. It's not the pumps as being the
right.
Primary
source.
Right,
it's just like you can poke holes in Jell-O, and it doesn't affect the integrity of the Jell-O.
Right. It's still Jell-O. So I guess my question is, Ling did some amazing work, basically blew this whole theory of sodium potassium pump as being the primary driver of this charge, blew that out of the water. I mean, it's quite obvious. When did he produce this work, and why don't people, why isn't Texas Tech University here in Lubbock cell physiology department teaching this?
This was started in the 40s, I think, and he went until he kept working until the early 2000s, and he had some students, and Gerald Pollack worked with him and credits him with his inspiration, and Mei Wan Ho was a Chinese PhD in biochemistry, and she carried on and wrote a bunch of books and papers on this. I mean, why? I don't know.
That's the same as people ask me, why don't people understand that nutrition can affect eczema?
Yeah, I don't
know. Or you name the disease. We're just not taught it for some reason. The curriculum committees somehow.
I mean, he had his theories that, you know, like the guy who is in charge of peer review had, you know, got a Nobel Prize for the sodium potassium pump, and anybody who does a paper saying it's nonsense, he doesn't publish it.
Yeah, right.
It's just a weird system, and it's designed to enhance orthodoxy, so to speak.
Right. Yep. Well, questioning conventional wisdom, like you've always done, is a very beneficial thing for humankind, it seems like, because the things that are produced, when you actually get down to the truth, you can produce health, or you can figure out what's disrupting normal physiology and therefore producing sickness and disease. One thing I wanted you to comment on, you mentioned in the book, Dr. Pollack, who we've interviewed on the show before, but I missed this part when I was talking with Dr. Pollack. Obviously, the negative charge is created by this structured fourth phase of water. But then you mentioned this, that Dr. Pollack states that this water, this intracellular water, jello, can also receive information, kind of like an antenna receiver receives information. Can you speak to that anymore, or is there any, you know, more research or depth to that?
Gets into the question of why does this theory turn up like in a book on vaccines and autoimmunity.
Exactly, yeah.
So here's why. Because there's basically two reasons. So one, if your cells don't have a proper gel and therefore they can't create this charge, they can't do any work, so that's a problem, and they can't keep their distance from the other cells. So the cells then clump together, uncharged cells clump together, and that's what we call a tumor. And interestingly, Max Gerson, who came up with the Gerson diet, said what his whole nutritional approach was all about restoring the sodium-potassium balance. And so it's interesting. He didn't quite get it right because he didn't know all this, but that's what he thought he was doing. So that's one repercussion of this. Essentially, clumping together of the cells, i.e. tumor formation, is a consequence of the poor formation of the gels and therefore the charge. Now, the second one, and the one you alluded to, which is essentially what, so that isn't part of the book, it's part of the next book on cancer, but the reason this is related to vaccines is, so the way to think of this is, If your gel, your water crystal, which is in a gel form, is what I would call perfectly formed, then you're a perfectly healthy person. So now let me flesh this out. So let's say you go to your screen and you have a perfectly formed mosquito screen on your window. So then it works perfectly well and it keeps all the mosquitoes out and keeps, you know, allows the air to get in. That's the function of the screen. And insofar as your gel is perfect, then it can do what it needs to do. It can get rid of the sodium, collect the potassium, and create all this energy. Now, the reason that water is used, or, I mean, that's a certain way to say it, but the repercussions of this is water has an infinite number of binding sites so that if anything interacts with the water, and this could be thoughts, feelings, arsenic, you know, hormones, proteins, lithium, anything. Anything that will interact with one of these binding sites on water will create a change in the structure of the gel, and so that will make different things happen in the cell. And so that's how, essentially, that's how we work. We have this infinite number of binding sites because of the nature of water, which has itself, water gels have infinite number of binding sites, and they can bind with basically anything. And that creates a change in the mesh, and that tells the DNA to do something, it tells the ribosomes to do something, it tells everything to do something. So that's the communication system in our bodies, in our cells. Now, imagine a situation where you dissolve a whole bunch of stuff that's not supposed to be in the gels. Let's say, keep up with our earlier discussion, let's say you put a whole lot of DDT in the cell. Now, instead of having a perfect mesh, you have a mesh that's distorted, so some of the holes are too big and they let the mosquitoes in, and some of the areas are all squished together so no air can come in. And that means you have a dysfunctional mesh, and that mesh can't receive outside signals, whether it's from thoughts, hormones, feelings, or whatever. It's a bit like if the cell is working perfectly, you have an in-tune radio, and if you dissolve DDT in there, you're now, instead of 95.7, you're 95.6, and then all you get is static and things don't work. So the body looks at that situation and, in my view, says, we don't want these distorted gels, so we're going to use the only mechanism we have, which is to heat up the gels. That means fever, and that allows the gel to liquefy, which allows the gel to run, and then you can run that liquefied gel out of the body with all that dissolved DDT in it. We call that coughing and mucus and diarrhea and snot and all that stuff. That's what we call being sick. And once that detoxification elimination phase happens, then you can reconstitute, hopefully, a perfect gel again, hopefully this time without DDT in it, and then you can go about your business as a healthy human being. That's why we have this system in the first place. Now, the problem is, if you keep putting DDT or, you know, thimerosal or aluminum or glyphosate or any of these other things that are in vaccines, or you keep having, you know, infections, or you keep having negative thoughts, you know, all these things that make us sick, you keep distorting the gels, and then you end up with a situation of chronic inflammatory response as your body is in a sort of a heroic attempt to keep these gels liquefied. Eventually they scar down and get hardened and dysfunctional and they can't run, and then you've got a mess. And that mess is what we call chronic disease. And in my view, it's this sort of new biology that I'm talking about, that's how it comes about.
Wow. That really ties so many different things together. We've interviewed a few experts about glyphosate and other vaccine folks, and Dr. Bruce Lipton talking about thoughts and our belief systems affecting physiology. And, of course, Dr. Pollack and the fourth phase of water. And this kind of just brings it all together and really...
this is the mechanism of how that works.
Yeah. Well, the epigenetics, which is a word we preach all the time in our clinic, and I'd say 99% of Americans don't even know what that is, all these influences outside our genes, outside that double helix DNA, that impact and turn on or turn off the bad genes is kind of how we talk about it, even down to thoughts. I mean, we talk about Dr. Emoto, who took all those different pictures of water crystals, and how the shape of the water molecule changed Then he took photographs of it when you spoke.
Right.
Positive words, affirmation and love and encouragement versus negative words, and how it changed the shape of the water molecule. It's fascinating. But all these
right.
different factors from thoughts, words, obviously these toxins, the lack of nutrients, stress hormones, all these different things, and the impact on the intracellular water, which therefore impacts energy production, the function of the cell, the job it has to do, even the DNA expression, the replication and expression of the genes.
The director of the Human Genome Project clearly said that the thing that controls which genes are turned on and off is what he called the interstitium, which is what he means is, if you look at the DNA, there's this molecule that is embedded in a gel matrix of course, water. And the gel matrix exposes or masks different areas of the gene depending on, quote, what it wants. I mean, it's not like, you know, saying I want this, but based on what its influences are. So this is not even like, I mean, it's not like my theory. This is what we know about how DNA gets expressed or not expressed. It's not the DNA itself. That's just bits of information. It's what happens to it, and that's the interstitium, i.e. the structured water.
Yeah. Well, I explain it to my patients. The DNA, the genes, it's full of information. It's like books on a bookshelf. But they're just sitting there on the bookshelf. And what directs the librarian to go to the third shelf, go to the second book from the right, go to page 34, paragraph 2, read it, and then I'll do what it says. That whole directive is epigenetics. It's influenced, I'll just read from your book. It says, the infant number of binding sites in the water is a perfect receptive vehicle capable of binding with hormones, vitamins, nutrients, sunlight, sound, light, and I believe even more subtle energies such as belief and love. I mean, there it is in a nutshell. Those are all the things that tell your librarian which book to go pick up and read and do what it says. So genes are so secondary, and all this epigenetic stuff, including love, is the primary. It's fascinating. So, I mean, this book is amazing, really. I mean, it's so confirming to what we've always believed at our clinic and what we preach every day, but it's cool to see the science coming around and proving it, basically. But the way you lay it all out and connect the dots, it's really incredible. So thank you for writing that book, and thank you for being on our show. We're about out of time. So a couple things I'll ask you to close it, but how do people, what's the best way to follow you, like a website or Facebook, or just to get your books and or know when a future book comes out? You mentioned your next book on cancer. What's a good way for someone to kind of stay in touch with you and your thinking and your latest stuff coming out?
Yeah, we have three websites. One is my practice, which is fourfoldhealing.com. That's all spelled out. And then there's a website that came about as a result of the Heart book called humanheartcosmicheart.com. And then my family and I started a business where we make vegetable powders out of food that either we grow or have grown for us, or wild food, called drcowansgarden.com. And so I sort of write a weekly blog about food and stuff for that. And so those are the three places to hear about me right now.
All right. Awesome. When will the cancer book be out?
Let's give me about 9 months to a year.
All right. Well, I think it was about a year ago, September, we interviewed you for the Heart book. I encourage everybody to go listen to that in the archives too, September of 2017. So
right.
We'll just pencil it in for September 2019, maybe. No pressure.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's Dr. Thomas Cowan, MD, fourfoldhealing.com, and check out his book, Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness. And you are listening to You're the Cure. VeritasMedical.com is where the archive shows are at. So y'all come back next week, and we'll do it again. Thank you, Dr. Cowan, for being with us.
Okay. Thank you.